Justin Thomas wants more positive stories, he should just pay attention to the Fire Pit channels, because that's what we're all about, is telling these feel good tales.
I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
Hello, this is Alan Shipnuck back for another Fire Drill podcast. Here at the FPC, we're coming off a great success at the Wishbone Brawl. Presumably, you guys have seen all the content we blasted out. It's always a highlight of our year and just one of the real feel-good events of the golf calendar. A couple of the sponsors of that gathering also help us keep the lights on here at the Fire Pit Collective. So big shout out to Link Soul, who provides all the clothing for us and just quality people to be involved with. And of course, Olokai Shoes. I was telling someone recently, that's pretty much all I wear. And even if they stopped sponsoring this podcast, I would continue to wear the shoes. Like, they're just insanely comfortable. I have really bad feet. I don't want to describe them in detail because that might scare off the listeners, but they're the most comfortable shoes I've worn in a really long time. So thank you to Olokai. And of course, Dormy Workshop as well, purveyor of beautiful artisanal leather head covers and stash pouches and all kinds of cool stuff. So we appreciate all of you. So let's get to this podcast. Matt Janella is here. We thought it would be fun to kind of catch up on what we're working on. We've got this In the Dirt series, as we're calling it. Hopefully you guys have seen some of the content we blasted out on Golden Gate Park and Paso Tiempo. And we have some great intel on Shorties, the new par three at Bandon that we're going to be putting out shortly, as it were. And so just some fun, exciting projects that we'll get into in a little more detail here. And so without further ado, Matt, what is going on in your world?
On Sunday morning, after saying goodbye to Laird Sheppard, by the way, the British AM champ was in town and staying at our house. Got to play Friday skins and Saturday round at Goat Hill Park with the British AM champ over the sort of the end of last week. And he's on his way to Palm Springs, playing in the Asian Tour Q School in Palm Springs. So great to reconnect with Laird. If you've watched some of what we did from the grind, you know his story, in which he was 8 down with 19 to play in the British Amateur Championship at Nairn a couple of years ago, and came back to beat Monty Scousel in a 3-hole playoff. 8 down, 19 to play, 4 down with 4 to play, and wins on the third playoff hole. So really cool that he was here, and he was teaching Bandon how to play soccer in our backyard and showing him some stuff on the golf course. So it was really sweet. And then Sunday morning, I darted up to San Jose, went out and met Justin Mandan, the superintendent there, and got eyes on ultimately what's really a finished product at Paso Tiempo. They will reopen to the public on December 4th. The front nine, the back nine has been open. You can play it, once or twice if you so desire. But the front nine will reopen to the public December 4th. That'll stay open all the way through April. So you can play all 18 holes with the new front nine greens and the back nine as it is until Western Intercollegiate, which is at the week after the Masters. So, and then they'll shut the back nine down and do the same exact process that they did on the front nine, which is, really go down and find the original, the greens, the intent of Dr. Alistair McKenzie and Marion Hollins as it relates to those putting surfaces. And Jim Urbina, Justin Mandan, Earth Sculptures, a big sort of team has been a part of that project. And I honestly had a beautiful morning out there. We had our drone shooter, our drone ninja out there, and recreating some of the same angles he's been doing throughout this entire process. And the before and afters are going to be spectacular. The putting surfaces at Paso Tiempo on that front nine went from one, maybe two pinnable locations to now in some cases, like 5, 3, 5, 8, the par threes are going to have, you know, 7 to 11 different pinnable locations. They took the greenside bunkers down to their original intent. They've got, you know, as we've documented, they've got photos and, you know, information. They went and were able to read the layers of the sand once they really cut into it to see that original, that original green and the sort of the breaks on that green to try to use as a base for the recreation and restoration.
That's so cool. That's like archaeology. That's not architecture. That's a different discipline. Like they're reading the striations of the earth there to figure out the subsoils and the sand buildups. Like, I love that.
It's actually the perfect word, honestly. And I think, you know, they had done so much soil sampling and understanding, you know, in Justin Mandan, that superintendent, they, you know, Pasa Tiempo has the perfect guy. He grew up in the area, lives in the area, you know, obviously, and he is so well versed on that golf course. Scott Hoyt, former general manager, Steve Argo, now the current general manager, that board of directors, that membership. I was there that day in April when they kind of shut everything down. They had a barbecue. They had 200 plus members out there. The amount of information and education that went in to getting that that project lit and getting that to go and where it is now, as we are here in November, this is going to go down in history as one of the smartest and most effective, you know, restorations of very meaningful putting services that, you know, that are accessible, you know, to the public. It is a members club. It is semi-private. It's a very different business model than we see in most American clubs in terms of the prestige of what we're talking about. Usually these, a course like this would be behind gates and you'd only get access to it if you were willing to pay $100,000 up front or $200,000 or $500,000 or whatever that number
exactly.
is.
Exactly. I mean, this is like the UK model. Like even Muirfield, you know, which is the Augusta National of Scotland, super stuffy, uptight joint. They still let outsiders play, you know, what is it, Tuesday and Thursdays. And I've had this argument with so many people, like these great private courses, to me, it's a travesty that 300 guys get to play them and a select few other guests. Like, I mean, like Cypress Point to me is like Yosemite, you know, it should be a national park and let the members have it maybe 5 days a week. Let everyone else come in and play in the other two. Like this is a part of the California coastline. No one owns California. No one owns the Pacific Ocean. Like, these things bother me. And you and I have always loved Pasa Tiempo. We've talked about it glowingly. I think it's still an underrated course. It's not always on people's radar screen, but it is open to the public. They set aside chunks of times every single day. And it's because of this public-private model, it's not that expensive, relatively speaking. I was like, what, it's a third of TPC Sawgrass. You know, it's half of Pebble. You know what, it's half of, you know, some of these courses out in the desert. And Tee to Green, it's phenomenal, and the undulations and the land and some of the carries, and then these Alistair McKenzie greens are just wild and crazy and awesome. And the Good Doctor, you know, a lot of people know, lived and basically died at Pasa Tiempo. That's how much he loved it and cared for it. And so it should be the top of every golfer's list as a pilgrimage. And just wait, you know, maybe at this point you could wait another year when it's done. And it is going to be so spectacular because they didn't really touch anything tee to green, although they're tweaking some bunkers along the way in the fairways. But the greens had gotten so extreme from the sand buildup. And I don't think average golfers recognize, like, every time you splash out of a bunker, that like starts to raise the contours of the greens times 150 players a day times, you know, almost 100 years. And so the greens had just evolved to the point they were too extreme. So now you're going to be able to see the contours as they were designed, and it's going to be tremendous.
It was almost, it had gotten to a point where they weren't even able to like mow the greens, let alone put pins on them. And it's not just that sand splash that you're talking about. It's top dressing. its natural runoff on the, you know, on that, on those hillsides and how that settles. And then, you know, and then it's the agronomy underneath it with drainage and sprinkler systems and, you know, and just the general health of the grass itself. So, you know, if you talk to some people involved and you find out that, you know, they were really, you know, Justin is very good at what he does, obviously, and he would get the greens very good, but there was only a limited number of seasons in which he was going to be able to do what he was doing, without, you know, without having to try to, you know, sort of push forward with a project like this. And they, what they've ultimately decided to do is go back to some of that original intent and reveal some of the original pin locations, but also some of the views and looks you see of some of the bunkers behind or to the right or left of some of these holes that you could see in images, but had been disappeared over these decades of time. And yeah. In Jim Urbina, you have a guy who spent a lot of time out of Paso Tiempo. He knows McKenzie. He worked with Doak on the sort of the restoration in which they, you know, going back 15 years ago, they didn't touch any of the greens at that time. And so you got this real thoughtful, well-informed architect, and you have Justin Mandan, and then you have Earth Sculptures, and you have this membership. It is what we've documented, and you know, the dirt that we were able to get into, so to speak, and see this process and the greens that we've played so many times that have befuddled us. And it's not to say they've made it. You know, people were like, oh, they're going to make it too easy. Those greens are what make Paso Tiempo. First of all, there's no way. Paso Tiempo is a bunch of half pars, and most of them are on the high side half. You know, they're like, they're, you know, number one is a par 4.5. Number two is like a par 4.5. Number three is a par 3.5. You know, like you just keep going and you're like, oh, this is just a bunch of, you know, half pars that are working against you. But it's also part of why it makes it so fun. But what they've done now is going to afford Justin to run those greens like he wants to at a 10, 11, or even, you know, upwards of a 11 and a half, 12 at Western Intercollegiate or something like that, and have pin locations that are still fair. Because yeah. When those greens were running 11, and you know, when the cameras were on and the Western Intercollegiate was being played, and you saw the ball never stop rolling, it was like, oh, this is unfair. They've lost it. This is no longer makes any sense. But that's not going to be the case anymore. There's real, like, legitimate shelfing and pin locations. They're going to be tough to get to, but they're going to be fair.
Do you remember we were playing there on the third hole, that incredible par three up the hill? I hit a career hybrid like to 4 feet, but it was past the flag and it was straight down. And it was like, I'm either going to make a two here or I'm going to make a four. And sure enough, I nudged the ball. It ran like 10 feet by. I missed the comeback. It was so deflating. Like, I hit one of the top 10 shots of my entire life and I left with a bogey. I think I had to rattle in like a 3-footer for my three putt. It was... Yeah, you could just get in some spots where you're absolutely dead. So it's going to be exciting. And
as much as I didn't want to see you miss that, I definitely had to make you putt it. You know what I mean? I seemed to.
Oh yeah, it. No, yeah, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't a foot and a half. It was like 4 feet.
But same that could be said on 8. You know, 5. If you're above the holes there, 18 obviously was a mess. They had totally lost any, you know, legitimate pinnable locations on 18. So. This is, you know, we're in bed with Paso Tiempo on telling the story. So, but obviously that's pretty well known, but I'm telling you, regardless of that, I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, opinionated people that are going to take to Paso Tiempo. I don't think there's anybody who's going to walk away and go, what's been done here is phenomenal. And there's a great big congratulations to everybody involved. And they can't wait to get started on the back nine. they very smartly did the front nine first, although there are these iconic holes in these greens and those three par threes that we've already mentioned, plus number nine, two really needed a lot of work. I mean, the back nine, you've got, you know, 10, 11, 12, I mean, 16, 18, those should be hanging in the Louvre. Like that's legitimate artwork out there. So for them to get a real grasp on the process, get a system in place, learn what they needed to learn on the front nine, and now take all that knowledge into the back nine. This is, you know, come this time next year, they're going to reopen all 18 with all new greens. And, it's going to be something to behold and something to see and feel and play.
I mean, yeah, we do have a business relationship with Paso Tiempo now, but we've been touting that place for 30 years. So I don't think we're in the pocket of Paso. We've always loved it. Now it's
just I know. Fun to, and it, to and the fact that it's so underrated on these rankings just pisses me off. It's like, do people even understand what they're looking at when they stand on some of those tee boxes and look out to those green, those bunker complexes and the green complexes? And, you know, as someone was just saying in one of the social comments that Doak said, how do you make such a short course play so long? Well, you know, it's because of the undulation. That's how it happens. It's a hike to get around there.
So. For sure. So, you know, we talked about the dirt. We've kind of got this, we're calling in the dirt. It's going to be the umbrella for all these projects that are working on the fire pit, course restorations, new builds, anything related to bringing golf courses to life, which, you know, we've already been doing over the last 2.5 years, but it feels like it's accelerating. And one project that we're both, you and I, are super excited about, as we put a few things out on social, you can detect the energy in the whole golfing world, is Golden Gate Park Golf Course, this little par three. A lot of people never knew it was there. It's the very western edge of Golden Gate Park. I mean, you're about one good drive, it's probably 300 yards to the beach. And it's right in the shadow of those famous like Sutro windmills that are out there, and just an incredible spot in one of America's greatest, you know, urban oases. And this, you know, you and I have both been there in the last few weeks, and to see, you know, we've been in the dirt since, you know, I guess 8 months ago, and to see it coming to life now, the grass has grown in, the sand scrapes are visible, the greens, you can see undulations. After your last visit to the completed Golden Gate Park par three, what's your feeling about that place?
Again, I'm just really happy for everybody involved. And, you know, Josh Lewis, Jay Blasey, Dan Burke, I met some locals on this last trip after Paso Tiempo. I darted over to Golden Gate Park and, you know, sort of, it's not as far along in terms of the health and strength of the grass, but it's pretty close. You know, one's bent and bent grass greens, and the other at Golden Gate Park is using fescue, and fescue, you know, needs a little, you know, little more time to sort of get in and get some strength. But I think long term, it was the right move for the way they want that golf course to play, firm and fast, and have the ball move around after it's on the ground. Jay Blasey, obviously a big part of the Chambers Bay project with Robert Trent Jones Jr. And you know, this was a cool project all along. You know, and we talk about it in our docuseries that's going to be, you know, starting to drop. Content started to drop next week, but you know, in the legacy of Sandy Tatum and what happened at Harding Park, and Dan Burke knowing Sandy Tatum and working and being a big part of the San Francisco golf community, and what it meant to him now as the CEO of San Francisco First Tee, for him to get some private donors, $2.7 million, to get Jay Blasey, again, lives locally. And Josh Lewis, who's got a history going back to agronomy at Bandon Dunes and other prominent projects, this team, you know, walking around with them and some of the locals, and what's about to, you know, sort of be presented to the public, affordable, accessible, everything that you'd want from a 9-hole golf course in Golden Gate Park and a hub of a first tee program that needs a place to play. It's just going to get rave reviews. It's going to be a national curiosity. It's going to be a blueprint for what's possible. You know, we've said it many times. We're going to continue to say it. You know, for me, you know, and you know, John Ashworth at Goat Hill Park and Dan Burke at Golden Gate Park and you know what, obviously, you know, Mike Kaiser at Bandon Dunes and sort of Tom Pashley at Pinehurst, putting in the cradle off the front porch of Pinehurst Resort. And, you know, Steve Leary, the mayor of Winter Park, who decided to do what he did, you know, Western Golf Association and Kemper Sports and some of the people who are behind the Canal Shores renovation and restoration of that property, which will be home to a junior caddy program. And these to me, Alan, you know, are leaders in golf. You know, this to me is, you know, I'm super frustrated with professional golf, PGA Tour, LIV, the dysfunction, the greed, the bullshittery, as we say. I just find to Justin Thomas's point, actually, it's way more interesting and exciting to stay focused on some of these types of stories that, you know, this Golden Gate Park is going to be a rock in a pond, and the ripple effect that it's going to have on this community as it relates to golf and kids and accessibility and affordability is going to go on again now for decades. And it's really cool.
It's just a feel-good project for everyone involved, because the, you know, the locals, and I was out there on closing day for the old Golden Gate Park and interviewed this Japanese guy who's 91 years old. He taught his daughters and his grandkids to play there, and he plays there all the time. So much he has his own private park in place. And, you know, this is fundamental to his daily existence, this little course. And then all these first tee kids from very diverse backgrounds, you know, it's been their portal into the game. And then you have, you know, retirees who they're in the 50s and 60s, and that's just where they like to play, because that's the community. The fact that they get this beautiful new course at no cost to them, the city gets, you know, an asset massively upgraded at no cost to them. It's going to generate more revenue. It's just a win-win-win for everyone. And, you know, I think people in golf have been waiting for this leadership to come from the top down, like let the USGA and the PGA of America guide us through how the game should evolve. But it's really coming from the ground up. Like all these people you name checked, like they are in the dirt. They're the ones who are actually doing the work with the golf courses, with the customers. And it's just a more effective model. It's great if the USGA will come in and sprinkle $10 million on a Maggie Hathaway in, you know, this little par three in central Los Angeles. Like that's helpful. And that's going to be a cool project that everyone's going to enjoy, but it's not really replicable. But what is if every community bands together and says, you know what, we have potential here. We've got this old tired golf course that needs to be redone. And, you know, like you can do it like Ashworth. Like he's just out there in the tractor every day, more or less doing it himself with community volunteers. You can fundraise privately like they did at Golden Gate Park. But there's a way for every community to get itself an amazing public asset. And it's not going to come from the Fred Ridleys of the world, the Seth Waughs. You know, they're kind of in their ivory towers. I mean, it's really incumbent on each golf community. Like it takes some leadership and some passion, and of course it takes some money, but it's this movement that it feels like it's happening around the U.S. where people aren't waiting anymore for the USGA to come in and solve their problem. Like they're taking the initiative, and we're lucky now as golfers to have all these cool courses to look forward to. And I mean, I can't wait to go up and play Golden Gate. It's going to be a regular thing for me. And you know, Peter Hay, it's on 7 acres and the cradle's on 10 acres. And Golden Gate is on like 22 acres. I mean, it really feels expansive. And there's some long holes, you know. And, you know, if you're a good golfer, you don't need any woods, but you might want your 5-iron, you know, and there's like a couple 180 yard holes. And, you know, it's like real golf. It's not just a bunch of little half wedges and super interesting greens. You have ocean views up there at the top of the property. It's really all you want. And, I'm as excited about Golden Gate in its own way as I am about Passe Tiempo. They're different experiences, but both are going to be just, you know, fun factories. And it's just cool that the local golf communities have made these things happen on their own, but all of us get to enjoy them.
Yeah. I mean, I think to, you know, going on the list of people who are having impact, but Adam Hike, the CEO of Youth on Course, I was just at a Youth on Course board meeting. I've served on, honored to be part of that board for the last 3 years. And I tweeted out recently that they, in 2019, they had 1,045 courses signed up to participate in a program in which, you know, all the course has to say is, yeah, we're a part of this program, Youth on Course, and kids play for $5 or less. And then Youth on Course subsidizes the difference between whatever they charge those kids and whatever they would normally charge a junior green fee. So Youth on Course is subsidizing kids to make sure that they have access to these courses for, you know, for $5 or less. They've doubled the number of courses in the last 4 years. It went from 1,045 to 2,035. They've gone from 70,000 members of kids in 2019 to 189,000 members in 2023. They went from subsidizing 204,000 rounds in 2019. This year, they are up to 700,000 subsidized rounds of golf for kids playing for $5 or less. So you talk about like leadership, you know, and the USGA has sniffed around on trying to be a part of Youth on Course, but they wanted to kind of own that concept and idea. Other big, you know, sort of, you know, brands within the game have talked about like, you know, partnering with, but in the end, it's just been Youth on Courses. You know, Adam Hike started as an intern and he's now the CEO, and look, you know, the kind of impact that that program is having. That's, you know, it's one thing to like throw up a bunch of commercials and use hashtag grow the game. That's growing the game. Golden Gate Park is growing the game. You know, Goat Hill Park is growing the game. You know, Canal Shores will grow the game. Western Golf Association is helping kids not only become like golfers or caddies, but become great members of society. And, you know, I just think this is, I get inspired, like, you know, every time, to your point, going to Golden Gate Park and walking around and listening and watching and learning, it makes me feel and sharpens my focus on some of the good stuff happening in this game around some of these courses, these municipalities, this accessibility and affordability and sustainability, to your point, being 10 acres, 7 acres. Think of Davis Cessna, who started threes, another par three course. I mean, and we're going to get to the news out of Bandon Dunes at Shorty's, which is another par three course, but this to me is, it makes so much sense. And as I said, and I think the previous podcast, after the Colorado Basin Water Summit, in which one person asked the crowd, if we were to start building golf now, what would it look like? If we erased the slate and started over, what would it look like? It would look like Golden Gate Park and Goat Hill Park and Canal Shore. It would be small, fun, accessible, sustainable, affordable, playable, you know, on smaller pieces of land. And that's what I think deserves a lot of our time, energy, attention, and storytelling.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's talk about Shorty, just because there's some excitement around that. Anything Bandon related, and obviously we talk about golf this century and part of why it's evolved in such a positive way. Clearly Bandon is a huge force in that. And it's almost a victim of its own success because it's so crowded. It's hard to get tee time. They're building courses as fast as they can. And so Shorty's will take some pressure off the preserve. It's going to be another par three course. And I think maybe they want to make it visually a little different than preserve, but whatever it's going to be, we know it's going to be fun. It's an awesome piece of ground there. Kind of for those who have been to Bandon Trails, when you're playing the first hole and you're in those dunes and the second, really, I mean, it's really kind of just over the, between those dunes and the coast, right? That's where Shorty's is going to be, and pretty wild and woolly. And what do you know about what's happening up at Shorty's, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, just that it's kind of coming online. I've talked to Rod Whitman and Dave Axlin, along with Keith Cutton. That is the team that ultimately got the job. At one point, you know, it was going to be Tom Doak. I've heard a couple different stories as to how and why he isn't doing it, and they are. I'll just save those for another time, because at this point, I don't have them confirmed. But Dave Axlin, Rod Whitman and Keith Cutton, you know, they were all part of the Cabot team. So Cabot Links, and Rod and Dave worked on Cabot Cliffs. They are longtime Corin Crenshaw associates. Dave Axlin worked on Bandon Trails. He didn't work on Bandon Preserve. So as I told him, I'm a big fan of your work for what you did at Trails. Rod had never actually worked on Bandon Dunes. He had been out there, but he had never had been a part of any of the Corin Crenshaw products. But can you imagine these guys having just sort of formed this new partnership fairly recently, not unlike what Keith Reb and Riley Johns have done. They continue to work for Bill and Ben, but they also take projects on the side and work for themselves. 19 hole par three course, the shortest being somewhere around 50, 60 yards, puttable. The longest being 150 to 160 yards. There'll be a lot of variety, not unlike at Preserve. You can kind of choose your own tee locations. Wild and woolly would be a good way of describing that land. Dave Axlin said the land itself and that dunes land, he called it a 9 out of 10. And then the challenge being, how do you make a golf course that lives up to that level of land? You know, he's like, you know, it's actually sometimes, you know, the pressure is on when you're you're at Bandon, B, you're in this portfolio of these great architects and architecture, you know, Mike Kaiser's, you know, legacy, a big portion of it. And you're asked to put in, you know, putting in a 19 hole par three course. So, you know, Dave Axlin was like, and they're so humble. These guys, you know, shocking guys that work with Corin Crenshaw are super humble, but like to talk to Rod Whitman, who, you know, Sam Houston, you know, in college from Canada, used to go out to pizza with Bill Corr. Bill Corr was a superintendent at the golf course that Sam Houston played at. Rod Whitman would show up with holes in the bottom of his shoes, not enough money to even buy the pizza they were eating. And they would talk about how they both wanted to sort of get into architecture. It's one of the great stories. I told it in a podcast. They actually tell it in a podcast that we did on the building of Bill and Ben, the partnership and the company. And so to talk to Rod and Dave and to listen to their humility and the sort of their honor and in the opportunity that they had to do what they did at Bandon is just a very sweet and refreshing reality. And I'm very happy again for them for this kind of opportunity that they've had to do this. There's no real set definitive date for the opening of Shorty's. They are taking reservations for sort of July on in 2024. There may or may not be an opportunity to open that sooner. That'll depend on the grow in and the weather and all that kind of stuff. So they didn't really get a chance to have preview play this year. I'm not sure how they'll handle preview play at the start of, you know, or the late spring into the summer of next year. But it is, as you say, kind of that west of number 2 and 3 of Trails. For the last few years, you've been off the second tee of Trails. You've been able to see like a little pin flag out there. That was the only indication that that was what was coming. A lot of the people who have been out there, say that these are some of the best views of any course on property. So think about that for a second.
I feel like on that first hole, I've pumped a few of my drives out into the Shorty's property, unfortunately. Why is that? That hole's always got that fierce wind. It's like, yeah. Damn.
It's can't such a hard, they didn't call it Shipnucks. It could have been Shipnucks.
Yeah, I think it's one of the hardest opening drives in golf, but that's just me. I'm a month away, actually less, from flying down to Melbourne for Ogilvy's tournament, the Sandbelt Classic, which is another of the really cool events in the sport that brings together a really diverse group of people, and it's all for a great cause. So, as you said earlier, I mean, if Justin Thomas wants more positive stories, he should just pay attention to the Fire Pit channels, because that's what we're all about, is telling these feel-good tales. Shout out JT. Love that guy. So I think it's time that the time has come to release the listeners. We appreciate you guys sticking around and following on with this little podcast. It's always stuff to talk about, and we'll keep filling up your inbox and your ear hole. That sounds inappropriate, but for Matt Janella, this is Alan Shipnuck. That was another fire drill. Thanks for listening, and this is the end.
I bet big and I played to win. Made a fortune when my ship came in. I ran the table, never thought I could fall. Then the wintertime hit me like a cannonball. And now I shake this losing streak. Every road I take is a dead end street. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think